Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, the death toll among essential workers due to COVID-19 is likely much higher than the official count. We find out why. And where does the right to free speech intersect with the rise of conspiracy theories? But first, seniors over 75 are among the first to get the COVID-19 vaccine. And for some, it's been a real challenge just figuring out how to get a vaccine. But as FM89's Sarith Hawk reports, it also offers hope that someday in the near future, there will be more freedom to enjoy life.
82-year-old Dora Garza walks out of the Madera County Health Department on a windy day in February. She's just received her first dose of the vaccine, and she says the shot was quick and painless.
It didn't hurt. And I would like everybody to get it, you know, that needs to have it.
Garza says she got the vaccine because she has a younger sister who's been hospitalized with COVID-19 for the past 2 months.
Her lungs are so bad, and it was all caused by COVID-19. And they just collapsed on her, and without the oxygen, she can't breathe. So it's really, really hard. It's been real hard for us.
Garza is one of several hundred people getting a shot on this day. Behind her, cars come in and out of the parking lot looking for spaces. Flags on the flagpole whip against the wind. Several signs point to the line for vaccines. Lester and Kathleen Moore are in their 70s. Unlike Garza, they had a tough time getting an appointment without computer access.
Everybody don't have a computer.
And not computer literate.
Lester says he tried for 3 weeks to call and make an appointment.
I just stayed on the telephone for about an hour. They finally answered.
Yeah, at different times, because he had called in many, 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 many times. But this time he stayed on. He hung on with the busy thing, so finally got through.
I had to keep calling and keep calling.
That's 70-year-old Diana Forster of North Fork. She also booked her appointment over the phone and says it was a challenge to get through.
Don't give up. Just keep calling. Just put it on redial and just keep calling.
Which is what she did.
No, I just knew that I had to continue, which is so important for everybody. I mean, we're talking children, adults, elderly, everyone.
She's hopeful the vaccine will give her back a sense of freedom. She helps care for a friend with health issues, and she's been extra careful.
Staying home. Not going shopping, not doing anything that we really want to go do. I get out once in a while, but that's because I don't have health issues.
Thomas Smith walks out of the health department with his 95-year-old mother, Violet, who just got her shot. He says it took about 3 weeks to find an appointment online.
And a lot of times, previously, I would pull it up and they were taking appointments, but then when I got through in there, they were all full.
Part of the problem, he says, he's not good with computers.
But I got lucky this week, and in fact, it was about 11:30 at night. I thought, well, I'll check one more time, and then they had an opening, and so it went great.
91-year-old Eileen Pettit says her daughter helped her book her appointment online. She also brought her here.
My daughter drove down from the mountains to bring me in because I didn't want to try it by myself.
Pettit says family was always a big part of her life. She misses going to church and other family traditions. She used to meet her siblings the first Tuesday of every month, a routine they've kept for at least 8 years.
We'd meet in Fresno for lunch, and it's been very nice because sometimes my daughter, my son, nieces, nephews would join us too. So it made it very special.
She says when they all get vaccinated, they'll do it again. It's what most of the people here today hope for. Being able to hang out with family again in person. It's what Lester and Kathleen Moore say they want. After all this is over, they hope to take a vacation.
We've got brand new great-great-grandkid we hadn't seen. So
hopefully we will.
The couple say they plan to drive all the way to Tennessee to see them. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Many hope the vaccine is the key to moving out of the pandemic, and the state has ostensibly opened up the vaccine for anyone over 65. But as we just heard from Sarith Hawk, many obstacles stand in the way between people and the doses they're eligible for. Here to tell us more is FM89's Carrie Klein with our weekly COVID-19 update. Welcome, Carrie.
Hello, Kathleen. Thanks.
So let's begin, as always, with a broad look across the valley this week.
Right. Okay. So if we start with just the case rates, case data, we finally have some definitively good news. New cases have fallen steadily. So they're now about half of what they were 3 weeks ago. That's tremendous news. However, you know, people are still dying at an elevated rate, but that unfortunately is to be expected. Death trends tend to lag behind the trends we see in new cases. But hospitals, too, are seeing a reprieve in both the numbers of beds occupied in general medical units and in the ICUs. And this is all generally true locally and across the state. And so far, almost 200,000 vaccines have been administered in the San Joaquin Valley. That sounds like a lot, but our vaccination rate per capita still falls far short of the rate statewide. And of course, with a little dose of reality this week, health officials are really urging people to not gather for the Super Bowl this weekend and turn that into a surge event.
Without a doubt. So with all of these changing rules, who is eligible for the vaccine at this point?
Well, that is, the million-dollar question at this point, isn't it? Or at least one of them. You know, the governor does keep changing who gets priority. And he appears to be doing that without always consulting local health officials. So they're often learning this at the same time that the rest of us are. Right now, here's who the state says should be eligible. High-risk healthcare workers, nursing home residents and employees, people over 65, educators, first responders, and food and ag workers. But every county is at a different rung on that ladder. For instance, Madera and Mariposa counties have started vaccinating educators. Fresno has been vaccinating farm workers, but cross a county line and it could be completely different. So the best bet is to check with your local county health department online or by phone.
Now, we've talked before about vaccine supply issues. Have those been resolved?
Unfortunately, no, and it's looking like they won't be anytime soon. So in Fresno County, for example, this was another week that no new appointments were available. They've still just been working on events with nursing homes and farm workers and getting second doses to the people who need them. The county also shared that they're simply coming to grips with a smaller allocation than expected. They're receiving about a quarter of the weekly doses that they were getting in mid-January. So they're having to scale back their mass vaccination sites for the foreseeable future and plan for a slower rollout. Supply issues are a problem everywhere, unfortunately, so it's likely a similar story across the valley.
Okay, so the rules keep changing and supply is lacking. What has the experience been like on the ground for vaccine seekers?
Well, notably, the system has worked for tens of thousands of people so far. Like I said, 200,000 doses have been administered. But for so many people, successful and unsuccessful, the name of the game seems to have been confusion. So where are vaccines available? How do I sign up? Why am I being asked for a health insurance card if this is free? All of this is confounding people. Plus, websites are crashing. Appointments may no longer be available by the time you fill out the online form. And if that form doesn't work, where do you turn next? So I spoke with Armando Ruiz. She's a community health worker, or promotora, in Los Banos. And promotoras should actually qualify under phase 1A of the vaccine rollout alongside doctors and nurses.
En la página del condado para vacunarme.
I tried registering online through the county website, but I just got this notification saying that I was on a wait, so I never got like an appointment. And after that, I tried to enroll at Golden Valley, that's a clinic, and they also told me that I couldn't register because at that point they were only registering people that were 65 and older.
She says she doesn't know where to turn next.
And then, since this is an online application, there's also the matter of those without access to the internet or a computer.
Yes, absolutely. And I talked about that with Isabel Solorio. She's a community advocate in Lanier. And she says broadband access in her part of rural Fresno County is hard to come by.
Tener acceso a internet es muy costoso.
First of all, even if we have, if you have access, the infrastructure for it, it is extremely costly in areas like where we live. And frankly, the older the population is that's mostly eligible for this vaccine, they have no idea how to use a computer. Very few of them have anybody to help them, you know. A lot of them don't drive anymore. And there's also like a lot of folks who are monolingual Spanish speakers who just like don't know how to maneuver all of the barriers to get the vaccine.
I can only imagine. And what about those who have successfully gotten the shot? Has their experience been smooth sailing?
No, not necessarily. And as an example, I spoke with Amy Roberts. She's a 66-year-old retiree in Fresno. She and her husband were able to squeeze in appointments in mid-January when the 65 and older category was just approved and before the mass vaccination site at Sierra Pacific Orthopedics stopped taking new appointments.
We left our house at 6:30 in the morning. And we got in line and we were in the middle of alluvial. So we had to turn the corner on Cedar and then turn the corner on Spruce. So I think our total time from beginning to end was 4 hours.
She says, you know, she and her husband took turns getting out and walking around. They chatted with people in other cars in line. Many of these sites have since become more organized, thankfully, but the time commitment may still be significant. And Roberts knows not everyone can spare a half a day or even a few hours to get this done. Plus, her experience making an appointment was stop and go. You know, it was hard to find the website. She had to start over a number of times, and she still found it hard to retrace her steps to explain to a friend where to go online.
Why has this been so chaotic?
Well, on the one hand, this situation is new to everyone, right? I mean, even health officials are human. And nothing is centralized. Every county is having to figure out outreach and communication and scheduling and logistics all from scratch. On the other hand, many say the disparities and inequities that are leaving elderly, rural, and non-English-speaking communities behind have existed since long before the pandemic. Here's Isabel Solorio in Lanier again.
Porque mis voluntarios nunca tuvieron lo necesario.
Our communities have never been taken care of like that, ever.
And of course, Lanier residents famously had to advocate for themselves for more than a decade to be able to afford water treatment for their community. But, you know, talking more about the vaccines, Armando Ruiz in Los Banos is also, you know, pretty critical of county health departments.
Trabajo mal hecho, mal coordinado.
They're doing a really bad job. She does think that they should coordinate better, get more personnel. They have to really invest in that and also in helping the folks that are 65 and older because they need the most help and they're not getting the resources that they need.
So given all of this, is it likely that this is going to get easier anytime soon?
You know, it's tough to say, unfortunately. You know, Governor Newsom has promised more coordination at the state level, though there are a few details. You know, LA County right now is piloting an app called MyTurn that may eventually help people schedule appointments across the state. There's also an independent website called VaccinateCA that's run by volunteers calling vaccine clinics every day to see if they have some available. And many counties are trying to partner better with local organizations actually on the ground, but it's chaotic and it seems like everyone is kind of overwhelmed right now.
It certainly does. Well, Carrie, thank you so much for this update.
You're welcome, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Free speech, as enshrined in the First Amendment, is central to what many of us consider to be the American experience. But the debate over the limits of free speech has been ignited by how the use of social media contributed to the January 6 riot and violent attack on the U.S. Capitol. To better understand this issue and the rise of misinformation and conspiracy theories, I spoke with Magdalena Wojciechak, professor of communication at UC Davis, and Nella Van Dyke, professor of sociology at UC Merced.
So there's been a lot in the news about this idea of deplatforming or taking away someone's access to social media. Obviously, Twitter's decision to suspend President Trump's account following the Capitol insurrection has made this topic front and center. And many are framing it as a free speech issue. Nella, I'm going to direct this question to you. Is it?
Well, it is a free speech issue, but the fact is that in the United States, private companies and other private entities, including colleges and universities, do not legally have to allow free speech. So private entities have to follow the law, but they don't have to follow provisions that are directly in the Constitution and are not reflected in laws elsewhere.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the divisiveness that we are living through. And Magdalena, you know, for so many years, the press was in this awkward position where they would report what President Trump had said and then go back and fact check the information. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've heard from people, you know, I teach at a community college and I've had students say to me, you know, the president says the media is lying. The media says the president's lying. They're probably both lying. So I'm not going to believe anybody. Can you mm-hmm. just talk about the effect of that strategy and how it is contributing to the polarization we are now experiencing?
This tendency is embedded in journalistic practice, right? We need to give equal voice to both sides of a controversy and cover different aspects of an issue. And that sometimes leads to this false balance in which groups or individuals in society who are not the majority or may not even have scientific or factual or expert knowledge are given airtime, legacy media, and spread their information and sometimes misinformation. That was very visible with debates on climate change, in which climate skeptics were given the same airtime as scientists who are showing that it's a man-made phenomenon. And the same goes for President Trump, that very often the media would report certain unverified information that he had disseminated on Twitter, for instance, or any other misinformation, not by the president, and then debunk it on air. And this is absolutely terrible from a social scientific perspective, because A, not only are you giving larger audiences or, you know, kind of free platform to misinformation or unverified information, and therefore you're spreading this information to people who would otherwise not even hear it. But also, even when debunked, misinformation has lingering effects. So people are likely to not really believe, but remember and be affected by the first piece of information that they heard, which could be misinformation, and may not be as likely to remember the correction, because correction is typically much more factual, much more complex than the clickbaity piece of misinformation that may be corrected. So there is a lingering effect. And that also, as you say precisely about your students, that can have this longer term negative systemic effect on decreasing people's trust in media in general. Because when the reality is so complex that, you know, everybody says everybody else is lying, I will not trust anybody and I will not even tune to news media at all. So I think that this journalistic practice is very, very detrimental to the health of society and to individual attitudes and knowledge.
Nella Van Dyke, I'd love to give your take on this.
Yeah,
I was just going to ask, given your perspective as a sociologist, what is your take on this topic?
Well, I think Magdalena has it 100% correct. And what I would add is that this whole problem is exacerbated by social media. So the social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter have algorithms that guide what information gets pushed and kind of placed on people's homepages. And those algorithms favor and prioritize information that causes strong emotions and information from like-minded people that people already agree with. So the effect then of if you have disinformation occurring in the, you know, regular news media, and then people are going on social media and promoting false stories, conspiracy theories, whatever it is, those kind of stories tend to evoke strong emotions, which then gets them pushed by the media companies on the other people's homepages or news feeds, which then makes people think, oh, wow, they get upset. They're seeing repeated messages that repeat the same misinformation. And they're seeing that, again, because it evokes strong emotions and their friends agree with it. They start to think, oh, wow, look at all of this. This must be true. And people do have a tendency to, or, you know, a predisposition to believe information they see that they already agree with. And so it just amplifies the misinformation.
Magdalena, I have to turn the conversation back to you because I would imagine you have more to say about this. What can we do to get out of those echo chambers, mm-hmm. particularly in social media?
That's a wonderful question. And I want to answer first saying that, A, political content or sociopolitical content is a tiny, tiny fraction of people's online exposures. So in one big study I did where I collected online browsing history of individuals, we found that only 2% of the content that people were accessing on their computers for 90 days was news. 2%. Everything else was, you know, email, weather, cats, food recipes, pornography. So most people are uninterested in politics and they do not attend to politics either, you know, in their browser or on social media. And those people who are interested and are using social media for political information or discussion are really unlikely to be in echo chambers. So echo chambers are a reality. I also have a big paper on that. But they pertain to a very, very small subset of a population. So those people are very politically active, very politically interested, and they have much stronger and more extreme political views, stronger partisanship and ideology, for instance. So I want to mention that our big and outrageous concerns about misinformation or echo chambers only pertain to a very small subset of the American population. And then getting out of those, right? Even if it is a small subset, it is important to break those and peer echo chambers and pierce those filter bubbles, because when it comes to, let's say, anti-vaccine movement, those echo chambers can have very detrimental effects and cause lives. But the people who are in those echo chambers and hold very, very strong views are the individuals who are the least likely to want to get out, right? They are very happy in their like-minded bubble where their views are reinforced and confirmed. So here, some algorithmic solutions could be put into place, but that's, of course, the job of the platforms or regulations that would require platforms to tweak the algorithm. But again, the people who are most likely to be in echo chambers are the least likely who want to get out of echo chambers. For those of us who are living in echo chambers, in that, let's say, most of our friends are Facebook or people on Twitter are of our respective ideologies or views, we can diversify our exposures by, you know, following news media organizations from the other side, for instance, or liking those pages on Facebook, and then, you know, the algorithm will work in a way that we will see the content from those pages. But then again, that's a very few people who are following news media pages to begin with, and even fewer who are willing to do what I just described and broaden their news exposure. Again, because most people don't care, others don't have the time, the resources, and so forth.
And I think most of us like to be right and like to be agreed with and don't want to be challenged. You know, I certainly relate to that. Nella, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Something I've been thinking about a lot lately is it seems like if you look back at human history, for most of it, the problem was not enough access to information. Now I feel like we're dealing with the effects of an excess of information. How do you think this over-access of information has contributed to the political moment we're living in right now?
Well, I think over-access, like the fact that we have access to so much information, makes it really difficult for people to filter and to know which sources of information they can trust. And so that's why I think it becomes all the more important that in, you know, our K-12 education and higher education, that we teach students and people to know what to look for and to know how to evaluate the quality of the information sources they're seeing. One thing I wanted to add in terms of how we can combat this is there's research that finds that when extreme right violence or the messages from extreme right groups is supported in the media by public figures, including politicians, but also media figures, that that leads to more extremist violence. And so it's very important that we have people, again, politicians, but also media figures, anyone in the public view, denouncing both extremist violence and extremist viewpoints that are objectionable and harmful. And so that is something you like to see happening, because again, when we don't counter it and we just kind of let it go, it spreads and it gets magnified.
Magdalena, I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether or not this moment that we're in was an inevitability, or is it really a function of actions that were taken deliberately by social media companies to put us into these tribes?
That's a great question. And I wouldn't go as far saying that those were kind of deliberate actions. As was mentioned earlier, that social media want our attention and want us to spend time on the platform. And it is the case that clickbaity and emotion-evoking information is prioritized by the algorithms because it's more likely to be read, it's more likely to be shared or liked. So this is kind of a side effect of this, that for some people, it will be the misinformation or different incitements to violence that will be seen on their newsfeed. But could the platforms have prevented it? What happened on January 6th, for instance? I believe so. There are different ways of detecting information that can be, inciting violence. There are different ways of dealing with such communications on different social media platforms. So, of course, it wasn't only, Facebook or Twitter. Those are the biggest players, so everybody's focusing on those. But, of course, there's Parler. There was Gab. And that's where a lot of organizing and very strategic communications happen about where to go and how to get there and how to break into the Capitol and so forth. So all this was publicly available and happening in front of everybody's eyes. The problem is, though, that, of course, detecting that kind of content, it's not easy, right? Like, of course, we can think like, Facebook or Twitter should be, detecting it, flagging it, or taking it down immediately. But this is not, it's not an easy job. So even though the platforms, some of those, such as Facebook or Twitter, are increasingly committed to detecting, flagging, taking down information that is hateful or incites violence, there are other social media platforms where a lot of the far-right extremists congregate, such as, again, Gab or formerly Parler, that do not take down or do not even aim to flag or identify that kind of content. So, again, the biggest platforms are trying to do their job. And, of course, we are focusing on them because they are big and part of the public scrutiny. So I don't know the extent to which that could have been prevented. To some extent, yes. But at the same time, it's not an easy job. So expecting that information will be taken down immediately after, 5 minutes after, within half an hour after it's posted, it's an unfeasible expectation based on my knowledge of how algorithms work and social media platforms operate.
Before we wrap up, I want to bring the conversation back to free speech, sort of following up on what Magdalena said. Nella, I'm wondering what you think about our relationship with the concept of free speech after what we saw on January 6th. Do you think that the public, that there'll be some sort of reimagining of what the First Amendment or what free speech ought to be in our society, given the spread of misinformation and how it led to the loss of lives?
Yeah, you hope so. People need to be clear that we have the right of free speech, but not all speech is legal. So There's various types of speech that are not legal, including speech that directly threatens an individual, speech that defames someone's character and is a lie in a way that causes damage, and speech that incites violence or creates a hostile environment. So there are various forms of speech that are illegal. And so speech that incites violence is against the law. It is also against the law to offer support or resources to people who are trying to overthrow the government. So I'll be curious to see if some of the, I mean, I think the social media have some jeopardy here legally, and I'm not a lawyer, but from what I read, in that they're providing a resource that people are using and used in the attack on the Capitol to organize. And it is illegal to provide resources to support overthrow the government. So again, that's where I think it's partly what's motivating Twitter to ban Donald Trump's account. But I'll be curious to see if others don't start, or, you know, if social media also don't, just including Parler, don't start facing some legal trouble for allowing their platform to be used as a resource for people planning this kind of action.
Just to add that, yes, absolutely. And Facebook has also taken down Trump's profile. And kind of just to complicate this fascinating question even further, you know, social media are, so to speak, neutral. It's the use that people put them to that takes normative evaluation. So also social media were used to organize protests around Black Lives Matter, for instance, or gender equality and Me Too movement. So this is where things are getting a bit complicated, that some movements and some groups are, you know, normatively problematic and use social media platforms for organizing, but other groups and movements are advancing human rights and equality and also use social media for organizing.
I wish we had more time to talk. There's so much to unpack here, but I so appreciate you taking the time. Nella Van Dyke, Professor of Sociology at UC Merced, and Magdalena Wojciechak, Professor of Communications at UC Davis. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having
me. This opportunity.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As a society, we've known for months that essential workers are more at risk of contracting COVID-19 than others. A new research paper out of UC San Francisco examines the risk of death among these workers, and it suggests that the death toll due to COVID is likely much higher than official counts suggest. FM89's Carrie Klein spoke with Yehung Chen, an epidemiologist at UCSF and the primary author of this study, about his team's research into excess deaths.
So among Californians of working age, 18 to 65 years of age, we estimate that roughly 10,000 more people died than we would have expected had the pandemic not occurred. That's only from March through October, and that represents a 22% increase. In other words, deaths were 22% higher than we would have expected had the pandemic not occurred. The way we did this was we basically looked at older data and we projected out what we would have expected to see had the pandemic not occurred.
Yeah, that's pretty tremendous. And so, okay, so those are the numbers that, you know, maybe it was a starting point perhaps, but mm-hmm. then you humanize those numbers by, as you said, examining these excess deaths by occupation and by race and ethnicity. In some ways, perhaps those findings were not all that surprising. You know, who did you find appears to have, suffered the highest mortality rates last year?
Workers among the food and agricultural industries, that was a big one. They saw a relative increase of 39%. We also saw large increases among workers in transportation and logistics workers. That would be things like delivery. Also large increases in facilities that would include stuff like janitorial services and construction.
And then by looking at these excess deaths by race and ethnicity too, the highest impacts appear to have been among people of color.
The greatest rises have been among Latinos and Blacks. And that's something that we, you know, we've seen with other studies we've worked on, and other people have reported similar things. And it's, you know, it's certainly alarming. It's certainly one of those things that when we first started working on this, we expected to see, but I certainly didn't expect to see such big differences.
But then, you know, there was at least one small surprise. I mean, if you talk about the mortality rate among the health and emergency sector.
Yeah, so that was an interesting one. I think, so the relative increase we saw there was about 20%, which is about in line with what we see overall for working individuals. And that was a little surprising. I imagine many of your listeners may have anticipated seeing a greater increase there. And our interpretation is that it's indicative of workplace protections that are in place in hospitals. I don't want to diminish the tremendous sacrifice that healthcare workers take and the risks that they face. And it's also not to diminish the horror stories that we've heard about, for example, lack of masks or scarcity of masks in hospitals, particularly early in the pandemic. But our interpretation of that finding of the 20% relative increase among healthcare workers compared to, let's say, a 40% relative increase among food and agriculture is that among healthcare settings, we tend to know that there are strong protections in place.
And so why are all of these people dying? Can we assume that all of these deaths, is there a way of knowing whether all these deaths are related to COVID?
It's a great question. And we have looked at that. And I mean, the short answer is that a large proportion of this is officially accountable to COVID. There's also another portion that we know and imagine to be unrecorded COVID. We know that there are, and we've heard this from physicians and anecdotally, and there's other evidence for that oftentimes COVID deaths aren't officially recorded as such. So that's part of the story as well. There's certainly other things going on, and there have been concerns about increases in non-COVID deaths. But our overall theory about this is that it's primarily COVID deaths.
So I think it became apparent, you know, relatively early on in the pandemic that frontline workers were especially vulnerable to this virus. Communities of color were especially mm-hmm. vulnerable to this virus. You know, what do you think is the value of a study like this that confirms in a way, you know, what in some ways we already knew?
It's a really interesting question because as we worked on this, I think we struggled with how valuable this might be to people. I think we had a sense that this was important, but at the same time, we also had a sense of what you're pointing to, which is that, don't we already know this, right? And in truth, the actual quantitative data on this has been pretty limited. And so the primary evidence on this sort of stuff has been documented instances of outbreaks or knowledge about lack of protections in workplaces or simply anecdotal evidence. Certainly, I think among people who work in these industries, among people who have unfortunately lost loved ones who work in these industries, I think these results are not very surprising. But what we saw actually when we posted this a couple of weeks ago was really that it really took off, and there's been this huge outpouring of reaction I don't want to say support, but there's been a lot of people who've reached out to us and are really grateful, I think, for this information. And I think it speaks to the prior lack of quantitative data on this.
And so quantitative data might actually allow for more solid steps forward to try and, you know, curb the virus in certain ways, perhaps.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're hopeful that this will lead to action on multiple fronts, and certainly workplace protections and also vaccination as well. That it's one thing to document outbreaks, but I think having data that are for the entire state and across multiple industries, I think is valuable. And keep in mind, especially, that a lot of the information out there prior to this, or a lot of the conversation prior to this, has been on the healthcare workers, which is deserved. But I think. I think we are proud of the fact that we are drawing attention, at least in a quantitative scientific way, to what's going on, for example, among the food and agricultural workers. We've been seeing some action this week, for example, with local actions on hero pay, of increasing pay for workers by the hour during the pandemic. There's ongoing conversations about the Cal OSHA regulations that were put into place in response to the pandemic. You know, we're glad to be part of this conversation and to provide information that can guide these decisions. And similarly with vaccination, I think, you know, that's this whole vaccination question is controversial, and it's unavoidably controversial. You know, the 65 plus model that the state has adopted and is a plan that really does make a lot of sense in many ways. And the reason being that most people who die from COVID are older individuals. That being said, I do think it's worth looking at other groups, especially because we know it will take a long time to vaccinate people who are 65 years and older. And I think particularly with essential workers, some things to think about are that essential workers tend to be younger and that they have a long life potentially ahead of them. It's also important to think about this whole idea of why we call them essential in the first place, which is that we view them as being essential to our society and essential to our economy. So if you think about food and agricultural workers, if you look at agriculture and specifically, which I know is important to the Central Valley, agriculture this industry doesn't just put food onto the plates of Californians. It's providing food for the nation and really people all over the world. And so I think these workers have a really important, you know, place to play, and that that needs to be taken account in this conversation about vaccination. I mean, a third area to look at here with essential workers is the racial elements. We know, for example, that Latinos make up a large proportion of agricultural workers. When you look at the 65 plus plan, we know that the age distribution of COVID deaths actually depends on race. And so you're actually, the coverage of the 65 plus plan doesn't work quite as well by race, because we know that Latinos and Blacks, the deaths are occurring at younger ages.
Right. Well, Yehung Chen, epidemiologist at UC San Francisco, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The Fresno Philharmonic prepares the next of their Digital Masterworks series on Saturday, February 20th, featuring works of groundbreaking African-American female composers. Valley Public Radio's David Ouse spoke with music director Ray Hatoda and Philharmonic president and CEO Stephen Wilson about the music and this exciting free series.
Let's get right to the music. Ray Hatoda, please tell us about the program.
The program is called American Visions. We wanted to showcase American composers, and who better than Aaron Copland and the Appalachian Spring. It's one of these wonderful pieces that everyone can really relate to. It's wonderful tonal expansive sounds and the familiar Shaker hymn at the end. We also think that his music really reflects a sort of a landscape of America, a visual landscape. So we thought it'd be really interesting to showcase Fresno's landscape, and really more importantly, the agricultural landscape. It's just a creative genius of our videographer, Tal Skloot, who embedded these scenes in the iconic Appalachian Spring music that you'll be hearing and watching in our digital premiere. So we're really excited about that. But in addition, we have three women composers, two African-American women on the program. Jasmine Barnes, a young, up-and-coming, rising star, and Florence Price, a composer from the earlier part of the 20th century. And then if we start the program with Joan Tower, a Grammy-winning contemporary American composer who was lauded by the New Yorker as one of the most successful women composers of our time. We will perform the fanfare for The Uncommon Woman, number one. It's inspired by Copland's fanfare for The Common Man. Number one is written for my mentor, Maren Alsop, the conductor of the Baltimore Symphony and several other orchestras. She's just this wonderful conductor and advocate for women composers, but also women conductors. I think it really speaks to everything that Marin is, but also to all of her mentees, including myself. And, you know, the risk that we take or the adversity that we face. And, but it's not just women, it's everyone, especially during this pandemic. And so I think it's hopefully inspiring to many. And it's just an incredible piece. And it's really a departure from Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man.
And then next on the program is Jasmine Barnes.
Yes, Jasmine Barnes is a Dallas composer and educator. She's teaching high school right now at Booker T. Washington. It's an arts high school in Dallas. She is a composition and theory and gospel vocal instructor there. She grew up in Baltimore. She grew up in the church. Her parents were both pastors. And she grew up singing. She said she was in church 24/7. But then she was also in band in high school. Those are her roots. And so many students out there in high school are doing all those things. And yet she really found a voice in composition. And she really pursued that. She really persevered with her talent and her need to say something.
Well, it's exciting to hear work from new composers. And in this series, the Philharmonic is presenting works of African-American composers in every performance. Would you talk about that a little bit more?
You know, especially since last year when George Floyd was murdered and all of that social injustice was happening, I think that was the end of the rope for everyone. And for me, it was a real wake-up call, especially in the arts, how we have really marginalized Black composers and performers and artists. And I think that we need to highlight them now more than ever. And it's been our mission to do this, not just this concert in February to highlight Black composers, but throughout our season.
Stephen Wilson, can you add to that?
This has obviously become a very important and pressing issue for the arts as well as for our whole society. And so we are very definitely looking at our need to commit to racial equity in really everything we do in our programming, but as to take this as an organizational-wide imperative. And so it's something that we're certainly taking this moment very seriously and want to make sure it's not something that just, you know, kind of stops when the pandemic is over, but that we keep this as, you know, as an organizational focus and priority.
Thanks, Stephen. So with that in mind, let's hear a little bit more about Jasmine Barnes.
When I discovered Jasmine Barnes' brass quintet, I thought, wow, this is different. This is saying something. This is a talented, talented composer. This piece is called Resistance, and underneath the title Resistance, she says, the resistance to comply with something.
And Ray, you recently had the opportunity to chat with Jasmine Barnes in this kind of format, and that's going to be released soon, right?
Yes, and everyone, please tune in on our Stay Tuned interview where I will be interviewing her. And this will be happening at 5:30 p.m. on Saturday, February 13th. She is a really up-and-coming, exciting composer that I'm really thrilled that we are performing her piece on this series.
And then another African-American composer on the February program, Florence Price, the first African-American woman to have a symphony performed by a major symphony orchestra, Chicago Symphony Orchestra, performed her symphony number 1. What's the piece we're going to hear from Florence Price?
Well, yes, the piece is called The Deserted Garden, and it's for piano and violin. And Stephanie Sant'Ambrogio, our concertmaster, and myself on piano will be performing this piece. It's a beautiful contemplative work. Florence Price is one of these composers that was marginalized. We need to bring her story to the light and to our minds and into our repertoire. She was born in Arkansas in 1887, and she died in Chicago in 1953. It wasn't until the 90s that her work was discovered in an abandoned house in St. Anne, Illinois. I'm from the Midwest. I don't even know where St. Anne is. But apparently she lived there, and this couple bought the property and was going through this house and discovered all of these manuscripts strewn all over the floor. Before she died, she had very few pieces that were printed. She had to find a publisher, and none of the publishers wanted to publish her music. And so a lot of her music was still in manuscript form, even until into the 50s. Now her music is being performed by major orchestras across the country, but I think she was the first. You know, I think she was really holding the torch for everyone else to walk through. I mean, there's four symphonies that she wrote. They discovered two violin concertos in that abandoned house. You know, if that couple didn't know who she was, they could have just thrown all of that music out, and we would be missing all of that incredible music by Florence Price. So we are so thrilled to share this duo for piano and violin in this series.
Absolutely. Looking forward to hearing that. And then the concert rounds out with Copland's Appalachian Spring. It was originally scored for a 13-member chamber orchestra. Is that the instrumentation that we'll be hearing?
Correct. Yes. And I'm very excited to share this piece with everyone because it really showcases all of our fabulous Fresno Philharmonic musicians in a different way. I mean, it's very much like chamber music. I want to reiterate that Copland's music is really deeply rooted in a sense of place. And this is what we wanted to bring to the forefront, our time and our place, where we are right now in this pandemic, that we're persevering. And the music is so hopeful. Whatever you're feeling at the moment, I feel like this piece really gives us a moment of respite. What's interesting about this commission by Martha Graham was that Copland also commissioned Isamu Noguchi, the famous sculptor, to do the set. So I encourage everyone, aside from watching our digital premiere on February 20th, to take a look at the original ballet danced by Martha Graham and the set by Isamu Noguchi. It's very minimalistic. I find it to be very Japanese and interesting in that way, but it's so innovative. You know, when you look at it, you think, gosh, I can't believe this was 1944.
I was going to say, I think Copland has this kind of folksy reputation, you know, and people kind of know him for that Americanist. But if you see video of the original ballet, you see his modernist roots as well. And I think the smaller instrumentation will be a discovery for many people who maybe just know Appalachian Spring in the full orchestra arrangement. And I think it definitely sheds a new light on the piece for listeners if you're not familiar with it.
Well, all right. Fresno Philharmonic premieres the next of their Digital Masterworks series on Saturday, February 20th at 5:30 p.m. Viewers can watch on the Fresno Philharmonic's homepage, fresnophil.org, or on the Fresno Philharmonic's YouTube page. Stephen Wilson and Ray Hatoda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.